The clerk will call the docket.
Allen, other, versus McCollum, and other. Charles J. Cooper, Michael W. Kirk, David A. Thompson, William D. Mara, Haley Ann Proctor, Petitioner Council. Mark R. Herring, Attorney General, Stuart A. Raphael, Solicitor General, Trevor S. Cox, Deputy Solicitor General, Matthew R. McGuire, Assistant Attorney General, Anna T. Bergenmeyer, Assistant Attorney General, Respondents Council.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Haley Proctor. I am a member of the Virginia Bar, and it is my privilege to introduce Mr. Charles Cooper. Mr. Cooper is a member of the bars of Alabama, Georgia, the District of Columbia, and the Supreme Court of the United States. He has been admitted pro hoc vice and will be arguing on behalf of the petitioners. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Cooper, welcome. You may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I first want to thank my colleague and sponsor here, Ms. Proctor, for introducing me, and I want to thank the court for granting me permission to appear before you. It's a great honor. I also should like to reserve some time for rebuttal, and it's my plan to reserve 10 minutes. We'll see how that goes. The question before the court this morning is whether it was the will and intent of the people when they adopted the constitutional provisions bearing on the governor's clemency power to authorize the governor to remove political disabilities consequent upon conviction on an en masse blanket basis, or rather whether the governor must exercise those powers case by case individually. The question is one of first impression before this court, because never before in Virginia's 240-year history has a governor exercised clemency power on an en masse basis. All 71 previous governors have exercised this power, including the power to remove political disabilities on an individualized case-by-case basis. Now that stark, undisputed fact is itself compelling evidence, we would submit to you, that the governor lacks blanket clemency power. For the entire record of human history attests to the implausibility that a power granted to and held by a chief magistrate, whether it be king, president, or governor, does not just lay dormant and unused for almost 2.5 centuries. And this unbroken record of consistent gubernatorial practice becomes, we would submit, well-nigh dispositive in this particular case. Because over that, for two reasons, really. One, over that 2.5 century period of time, our Constitution has been revised in a sweeping, wholesale manner by 6 different constitutional conventions. And secondly, our 2 most recent governors, previous governors, both studied the very question that is before you very carefully, and they concluded, both of them reluctantly, that they lacked power to enter en masse blanket categorical clemency orders, and in particular, the restoration power. That history, we submit to the court earnestly, should be decisive in resolving any ambiguity the court finds in the text of those provisions. And now let me move to the text.
Before you get too far into your argument on the constitutionality, would you address for me, please, an issue with regard to standing? Under Virginia law, outside of gerrymandering and malapportionment, what is the basis for your standing argument in the absence of a particularized injury?
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to predicate my standing argument on this simple proposition, and that is that it is inherent in the right to vote, the right to cast a full vote, one that is undiluted by unlawful government action. And Your Honor, I would submit to you the following from Reynolds versus Sims, the Supreme Court's seminal case on the right to vote and vote dilution. There is more to the right to vote than the right to pull a lever in a voting booth. The right to vote includes the right to have the ballot counted. It also includes the right to have the vote counted at full value, without dilution or discount. The right to vote can neither be denied outright nor diluted by ballot box stuffing. That's essentially exactly what...
In Reynolds v. Sims, though, wasn't it on a comparative basis,
yes,
looking district by district?
Your Honor, well,
what is the comparison here?
Your Honor, we would submit to you, you do not need, and the respondents cannot cite a single case holding that vote dilution claim and standing to assert one only lies in the context of dilution when compared to somebody else. There's not a single case that holds
that. If all are diluted equally, how are they then diluted?
Your Honor, Justice Reynolds versus Sims says they're diluted because
Reynolds v. Sims was in the context of district by district.
Yes, Your Honor.
Provide a citation for a district of the whole, so to speak.
Yes, Your Honor. Before I do, I want to simply say that not only can the respondent not cite a single case that holds vote dilution is limited to this comparative context, every case that actually addresses the issue acknowledges that it is not limited and, in fact, upholds standing in vote dilution cases where it is not comparative. For example, Your Honor, and by the way, I simply want to point out that many of the cases reach the merits of a claim of simple overexpansion of the dilution, not comparative or relative dilution, but overexpansion of the vote, without even discussing standing. Those cases are cited, Your Honor, in the Attorney General's amicus brief on my side, and they're cited at page 31 of that brief, and they're cases from the 2nd, 4th, 5th, 6th, and 11th circuits. They simply don't even reach the question of standing. It is accepted and assumed. The cases that do address standing in the context of overexpansion of the vote uniformly uphold plaintiff standing. The case I want particularly to submit to you, Justice Mims, for your attention this morning is Michael against Anderson. That was the case from the D.C. Circuit in which 12 members of the House of Representatives and voters from three states sued to challenge a rule in the House of Representatives which allowed delegates from five territories, Puerto Rico and four other territories, to vote in a committee of the whole. The court acknowledged that the congressman in that case, whose only claim was that their vote was diluted in this absolute overexpansion way. Their vote was no longer one of 435. It was one of 440. And it was acknowledged in that case that they had standing, but even more importantly, it was acknowledged that the voters from three different states had standing, even though their vote had standing to complain about that dilution, derivative dilution, even though their vote was identical to the vote of every American voter in the United States. A widely spelled, highly diffused, to say the least, dilution. And an absolute dilution, not comparative dilution in that case.
But then we have the Sixth Circuit, which says mere expansion of the people eligible to vote does not per se imply unconstitutional voting dilution. So when you look at the backdrop of our cases where we have required outside of malapportionment and gerrymandering that there be particularized injury, why would not we then apply that law to this case and require particularized injury?
Your Honor, it doesn't imply that the vote dilution is unconstitutional, as the Sixth Circuit said. But the Sixth Circuit has not denied their standing on behalf of those claiming that their vote is diluted to make that claim. I'm not aware of any case where that is the case as I've previously represented. And I think this Court's decision in Wilkins against West supports me in that, Your Honor. That was a case in which there was a challenge by voters to allegedly racially gerrymandered district and districts that were not compact and not contiguous. The argument there was that they, as residents, simply by virtue of their residency within the district,
as residents of that alleged gerrymandered district. So you're asking this court to expand the holding of Wilkins from a gerrymandered district to the entire state?
Well, what I'm saying is that I think that precedent supports my claim, and yes, certainly, if the residents, if the frame of reference is statewide rather than district-wide, then yes, you would extend it to, in that case, all residents in the state. But, Your Honor, the point of Wilkins and West is that every resident in that in those non-contiguous, non-compact, allegedly gerrymandered districts had standing, and they didn't have to show particularized injury. They were deemed to have injury simply by virtue of the fact that they were that they were residents. In our case, the claim for actual particularized concrete damage is far stronger because we allege actual, demonstrable, and statistically inevitable vote dilution for every one of the voters that are before you and the voters in the state.
Speak to standing of the legislators. We've spent a lot of time now at our request collectively on standing as voters, but speak, if you would, standing as legislators.
Your Honor, we believe that the legislators have standing to complain about an illegally configured electorate, an electorate that in which the ballot box, if you will, has been stuffed, in the language of both Reynolds versus Sims and Baker against Carr. But, Your Honor, candidly, we believe our strongest claim for standing is voter standing. All six of, including the legislators before you, are all voters throughout the Commonwealth of Virginia, and that's the claim of standing that we assert most forcefully. And so, if I may then, Your Honor, proceed to, well, actually, before I leave standing, I want to especially emphasize a case from the Supreme Court called FEC against Aikens. It's cited in our reply at page 22. That was a case in which voters sued the FEC to enforce their disclosure, public disclosure requirements of the federal law. Public disclosure. The court held that even though every voter in the United States suffered that informational injury, they called it, when the FEC didn't enforce those public disclosure requirements, it was a injury related to voting, the sacred right, and therefore that injury from every voter in the United States was sufficiently concrete and particularized to support standing. If that is the case, we would submit to you that it follows that a claim of actual dilution, statistically inevitable dilution, must also support standing. And now, if I may move again to the merits of our claim, I want to focus on the text of the constitutional provisions that are at play, Your Honor, because the respondents focus on what is not in the Constitution. They focus on what has been omitted, but what might have been said. But when you focus on the words that are actually used, we would submit there are five provisions in the Constitution that bear on this question. Every one of them points in the direction of my side, a narrow interpretation of the governor's power to restore voting rights. First, let me turn to Article 2, Section 1. There are two different, Your Honor, disenfranchisement provisions in that section. The first one, the one directly relevant here, obviously, is the felon disenfranchisement provision. And it states this: no person who has been convicted of a felony shall be qualified to vote. That's the first half. A general constitutional rule, permanent disenfranchising felons from voting. It continues. Unless his civil rights have been restored by the governor or other appropriate authority. The very next sentence, the second disenfranchisement provision, Your Honor, uses the same sentence structure, the same wording, with respect to those who are mentally incompetent. Provides, as prescribed by law, no person adjudicated to be mentally incompetent shall be qualified to vote until his competency has been reestablished. I want to make a couple of points about that, about these provisions. The first one is this. The second sentence uses these words to describe a process that is inevitably and necessarily an individualized process. Reestablishing mental competency is, by its nature, necessarily individualized. The same words are used, again, with respect to restoration of the right to vote for felons. The same wording and sentence structure. We think that implies that that's an individualized process as well. More importantly, as I mentioned initially, the provision for felon disenfranchisement sets up a broad, general legislative rule subject to a gubernatorial exception. A gubernatorial exception. And, Your Honor, that just suggests, we would submit very clearly, under our Constitution, felons are not fungible. And it is the exceptional felons that qualify for gubernatorial restoration. Your Honor, it's the exceptional felons. That strongly suggests, in our opinion, that that process must be individualized. Else, the exception could very readily swallow the general rule. And that's exactly, we submit to you, what has happened here. Effectively, the general rule, at least with respect to felons who have completed their sentence and who are no longer on supervised release, with respect to all of those 200 plus thousand felons, the general rule has simply been suspended. And I'll come back to that point.
Why don't you think that the exception is part of the general rule?
Your Honor, it is part. But it is exception. It is the exception. Your Honor, in this case, that general rule has been effectively suspended, nullified, with one sweeping, en masse exercise of clemency. Again, we think that general rule, subject to a gubernatorial exception, implies that the exception will be exercised on individual consideration and individual exercise. Else, again, the rule itself could be suspended with a single stroke of the pen. We just don't think that's... We think that to the extent there's an implication in that language, the implication, Your Honor, favors us.
Let me ask you a question. It's a little bit hypothetical. If there were a rule that said that one need not stop at an intersection unless there's a stop sign, is the general rule of law in Virginia that one need not stop at an intersection, or is the general rule of law that one need not stop at an intersection unless there's a stop sign?
Your Honor, I think it's the general rule. You don't have to stop at an intersection. And when you approach an intersection, and that intersection individually has a stop sign on it, then you exercise the power given, or the right given to traverse the highways in the Commonwealth on an individualized basis, individualized consideration for each intersection, Your Honor.
So does that mean if whoever the power may be decided to put a stop sign at every intersection, they've done away with the general rule?
Well,
and that would be unconstitutional if it were in the Constitution.
No, Your Honor. No, I think wouldn't
a parallel be that if the general rule is you have to stop at an intersection that has a stop sign, unless, of course, there's a police officer present and he waves you through because of exceptional circumstances?
Well,
isn't that the parallel to what we're talking about here? In which case, if the policeman showed up at every intersection and said, forget the stop sign, you can go through this intersection whenever I tell you to. In fact, all of you can.
I think that changed the hypothetical.
The question is, which hypothetical fits your fact?
Which one do you like better?
I believe I can embrace both of them. I believe they both suggest, again, a general rule subject to an exception that both hypotheticals imply is an exception that is individualized and is case by case. Now, I think I get the drift of where both questions are taking us, and maybe it's that, okay, if the governor is required to provide individual consideration and exercise his power on an individualized basis, then can't he just put up a stop sign in 206,000, or a go sign, I guess, with respect to 206,000 intersections or felons?
No, in my parallel, he'd be pulling up the stop signs that are already there, that were put in there by the Constitution.
But in my example, the Constitution didn't put any stop signs there. That's the problem. I mean, that's why it's a different hypothetical he's giving you.
Well, but this Constitution does put up a stop sign.
Mr. Cooper, you can use your time any way you'd like.
Excuse me, but you asked
for 10 minutes. I just want to remind you, you're down to 9. You indicated you want to talk about 5 textual reasons you're still on number 1.
let me proceed, Your Honor, to the second textual point, and that it relates to Article 5, Section 12, and that has two provisions in it, which we think the clear implication favors our narrower interpretation, and that is, first, the reporting provision. It requires the governor to communicate to the General Assemblies the particulars of every case and with his reasons for exercising clemency. And, Your Honor, it's hard to imagine language that could more clearly imply that the governor must consider every case.
Would the absence of it indicate that he does not have to?
Your Honor, and you're referring to the omission in the list of clemency of in this provision of the restoration power, the power to remove political disabilities. And, Your Honor, perhaps, I think that it would, as you have suggested. I think what the court has to do when it decides what does this omission mean, because the predicate of this exclusio unius argument is an agreement that with respect to every other clemency power, it's pretty clear from this that the governor must exercise it individually, and therefore also, or because he must report it clearly individually with his reasons. So that's the predicate of the question. So then the question becomes, well, what is the will and intent of the people by omitting that? We would submit to you there's two plausible answers to that. One is that it was inadvertent, given that the reporting requirement had predated by 20 years the addition of the removal power. Second, it's that if it was deliberate and it was thinking, we would submit to you that the deliberate intention was to relieve the governor and the General Assembly from whatever burdens were entailed with reporting what now are, at least now, many, many, many more removal powers, removal exercises than any other thing. But here's some additional clues, Justice Powell. First of all, that language also contains the words consequent upon conviction. And as we've argued in our papers, and I argue here today, the presence of after conviction is a very important textual clue that this is an individualized, not an en masse power in the governor. And in that regard, contrasts with the president's power, and is like the power of the governor of Arkansas in the Hutton case. And I really commend your attention to that case. which, with the same decision or issue that's before you now, the Arkansas Supreme Court identified this after-conviction limitation as being, as having the import that I'm suggesting to you now, but equally important with respect to the omission, Justice Powell, is the legislative history of the 1870 Constitution, where the removal power was installed in the Constitution. The Constitutional Convention asked the Committee on the Pardon Power, in words that I would submit to you plainly imply a contemplation that it's individualized, and these are those words. They asked the Pardon Committee, inquire into the propriety of clothing the executive with the authority to remove all political disabilities from any person who may become a subject of executive clemency when, in his, the governor's, opinion, the facts of the case warrant. That is plainly, plainly individualized consideration, we would submit to the court. And yes, it is true that the committee itself recommended the convention that no such power be given to the governor, no removal power be given, but the convention nonetheless installed it, and we think installed it in the way that they conceived of it when they asked the question, Your Honor. The final point I want to make, I reverted to earlier with respect to text, and that is the suspension clause. In our Bill of Rights, number 7 is a prohibition on the suspension of law without the consent of the legislature. It was put in place in order to prevent abuses of executive power by those who founded this Commonwealth in 1776. Fresh in their minds, and according to Edmund Randolph, a particularized reason was the Declaration of Indulgence of James II, which was a sweeping en masse exercise of the pardon power in that case. Finally, I want to suggest...
Can I ask you a question? What do you mean by suspension? What constitutes a suspension?
Well, Your Honor, a suspension of the force and effect of a law. And we would submit to you, Your Honor, that a sweeping clemency that effectively eliminates a punishment, a permanent punishment, from most or all individuals who are subject to that punishment is a suspension of that particular law. It's tantamount, amounts to a de facto suspension.
Aside from your argument that it should be done on an individual basis, help me with that. If he does 206,000 of them individually, he does 206,000 of them collectively, where is the suspension when the end result is the same?
Your Honor, we are arguing that our Constitution places upon the governor a procedural hurdle, a procedural requirement, just like the procedural requirement that it places on the governor when he considers a bill presented to him for his approval or his veto. He must return it with his objections. It's individualized. It doesn't say so, but it's clear that the governor must individualize, consider it. And why is that? That's in order that the governor's judgment be brought to bear individually, and that eliminates, or at least it minimizes, errors, and it protects against arbitrary government power. And that's what this procedural requirement does, Your Honor. And yes, a governor can abuse any power. Anyone can abuse power. But why was the requirement placed there in the first place? We would say, for this very reason. I have 1 minute remaining, Your Honor. If I may, please reserve that.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Stuart Raphael for the Governor and the other executive branch respondents. Let me start with the threshold issue of standing, Justice Smith, Justice Powell. I think that is the right first question to ask. We submit that there is no particularized, concrete, cognizable legal injury here. Their lead case, Wilkins versus West, as you pointed out, is a redistricting case involving somebody within a district challenging his district as a racial gerrymander. But Wilkins makes very clear, following U.S. precedent, that no one else outside of the district has sort of presumed standing.
Why is their argument, Mr. Raphael, that when you're looking at a statewide election, that the state becomes the district? And so, a la Wilkins, everyone in the state is, there is an inferred picture.
Right. I think the answer, Justice Powell, is that Wilkins involved a special situation based on a racial gerrymander. The U.S. Supreme Court had held in U.S. versus Hayes that everyone within a racially gerrymandered district had an actual injury because the elected representatives from that district would feel some kind of racial obligation.
But that's not completely true. The case also involved a freestanding claim under the Virginia Constitution, which had nothing whatsoever to do with equal protection.
That's right, Justice Kelsey. The court did extend the holding in Hayes to cover contiguity and contiguousness claims, but the court said it wasn't going to go so far as to allow somebody outside the district to raise the claim. We think that the controlling cases here are cases like Raines versus Byrd, and, well, they're not controlling, at least against their U.S. Supreme Court cases, but Raines versus Ford, Byrd, and the recent Evenwell case. In Raines, you had six members of the Congress claiming that their vote had been diluted because of the Line Item Veto Act, and the Supreme Court said, well, yes, but you're complaining about the political effect of your vote. You still have a vote, and that is that's exactly the same situation here. The petitioners rely on the Mitchell or Michael versus Anderson case from the D.C. Circuit in 1994, but recall that that case predates Raines by a year, and the district court in Mitchell, the district court in Raines cited Mitchell as authority for going the other way. The Supreme Court rejected that argument. It rejected the argument based on Mitchell.
Doesn't the sheer scale of the order suggest perhaps more opportunities for standing than if this had been a much smaller type expansion of the voting base?
That's exactly right, Justice McCullough, and that's the point we made, is that there is a statutory mechanism to raise these claims. There are many ways they could come up, but the one that the General Assembly created was in 24.2-431, which allows three voters to bring a claim. What they're doing here circumvents
how practical is that to find three voters to challenge 205 potential additions to the voting rolls, particularly if the list isn't available to date?
Let me unpack that a little bit. With respect to how you find them, you have a right of access to the registration roll, so you can go in and look and see who's registered. You could look at the amicus briefs in this case. There have been seven voters who have self-identified. You could read the newspaper and watch the TV and see all these people who have identified themselves as having their rights restored.
Why can't you just get the list? Why can't the list be made available to the citizens of Virginia and then let them exercise whatever rights they have?
Well, Your Honor, that's frankly a different controversy than what brings us here. The governor has his position that there isn't a list. It's really a static database. There isn't a list, and that will be played out in a different forum. That doesn't go to the question of whether the governor has the power here.
Well, counsel, a static database versus a list, it seems to me that the data on a database is a list. Maybe I'm just simple and I'm going to think of it that way. But the governor's failure to provide that public document may be the fulcrum on which standing turns. And I, for one, do not understand how it is that a document of such importance can be shielded from the litigants and from the citizens of Virginia. So speak to that if you will.
Well, Your Honor, I think that's answered by Powell versus Smith, which is a case this court decided many years ago where the plaintiff seeking mandamus was trying to get access to the applications, and this court said that the statutory mechanism in what is now 24.2-431 provided a complete remedy. And I don't think that the times are, it's much easier to get information now than it was back when Powell.
Not easy to get this one.
Well, Your Honor, as I pointed out, it's easy to identify people who you could use as the persons to bring a claim against. Justice McCullough, with respect to your point, you don't have to sue 206,000 people. You need a few test cases. And when you get an appeal of right to this court, expedited, and a decision in that case would be stare decisis. So it's really not a significant burden. And the court's already held in Powell that that statute provides a complete remedy. So you'd have to, I think, either restrict or overrule Powell to go the other way in this case. I want to point out,
if we, in mandamus, if a deposition is requested by a party, then the deposition shall occur. Would that list not be subject to production for such a deposition?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. The petitioner said that there was no need to take evidence in this case, and we agreed with that, except perhaps with regard to standing. So
it would require an amended petition.
It might. But
if there were to be a request for an order for that list, the governor would not resist such an order, would he?
If there were no legal privilege, absolutely not.
Okay. How does Evenwell affect your standing argument? You've cited that in your brief.
Right.
What is your argument with regard to that case?
Well, what Evenwell says is that the Brennan v. Sims line of cases on which petitioners rely was really about equality of population among voting districts. Justice Mims, you pointed this out. And Evenwell says that where you're claiming that there are more voters in one district than another, that does not state a vote dilution claim. And I want to draw the parallel between what the Supreme Court said recently in Evenwell and what it said earlier in Raines.
Was Evenwell a standing case?
It was not a standing case.
So they addressed the merits of the constitutional argument. How did they do that without standing being present?
Well, because the question was whether you had a cause of action for...
The merits of a constitutional claim, cause of action or not, if there's no standing by the petitioner, because the court has no jurisdiction without standing.
Well, you know, one could take that up with the Supreme Court. They decided on the merits and said there is no vote dilution claim under Reynolds.
Well, you saw the footnote in UL, right? The footnote mentions standing and dismisses it as a non-issue. But you make it the lead argument in favor of your position that there is no standing.
Well, I think it is the threshold question. And if you grant standing to these petitioners, then any voter is going to be able to challenge virtually any election law, and that would really take the standing doctrine far beyond where it's been. I also want to call to the court's attention the concerned taxpayers of Brunswick line of cases, which holds that when the legislature creates a right and a remedy, the remedy is exclusive unless the legislature says otherwise. And that fits like a glove, 24.2.
Is that a standing question, or is that a mandamus discretionary question? Because they're very different concepts. One is a jurisdictional issue, and the other is not.
Right. I think it goes to the question of what is a voter's right. And there is no common law right that they've identified. The only right that's been created is a statutory one. And
so is it a standing issue?
Well, it is, in the sense that the legislature can create a statute that gives somebody standing. And that's what the legislature did in 24.2-431. The Spokio case that was recently decided by the Supreme Court.
So before that statute, there was no standing whatsoever under the Virginia Constitution to file this kind of claim. But after the statute, there is.
I think that's exactly right.
Isn't standing a constitutional question? Article 3 says it is. Why not under the Virginia Constitution?
Well, it is a constitutional question. The court should not decide a case if it's not justiciable, if there's not standing. But the question is, does a voter have some kind of common law or constitutional standing? And we would submit that they don't. Only if a statute creates it do they have that power, and the statute has created. The statute, by the way, was enacted in 1924. There's a separate provision that allows somebody to file a petition with the registrar. That was created in 1874. We couldn't find any case showing that a voter would have standing to challenge governmental conduct.
But the argument here is not that. The argument you're making is that the statute precludes the conclusion that there's constitutional standing, that somehow this alternative remedy, which is relevant to mandamus discretionary judgment calls but not relevant to subject matter jurisdiction, precludes the conclusion that there's parallel standing under the Constitution.
Yeah. Since it's their burden, I think they have to demonstrate to the court some case that shows that a voter has common law or constitutional standing, and they don't have a case that says that.
Wilkins says that if the legislature violates the Virginia Constitution, the compactness and the contiguous provision, that every single citizen in every single one of those districts that is a voter has standing,
right,
statewide. Now,
No.
Within the affected districts, statewide.
Well, But the court dismissed districts where voters lived outside the district.
Right. So if you have a claim for compactness and contiguousness under the Virginia Constitution and you're in an area affected by the alleged violation, you have standing.
But Your Honor, the way that the Virginia law sets up voting is by locality, right? If precincts are within a locality. The election that's coming up is not just the presidential election. It's elections for members of Congress as well. And the way the entire election system is set up is based on those election districts. So I don't think that you can carve out an exception because this is a presidential election. And the position that you're talking about, I think, would have a slippery slope going the other way. Why couldn't somebody in California say, you know what, I don't want those re-enfranchised felons voting in Virginia. I'm going to file a suit in Virginia to stop. I don't think their position has a limiting principle. Let me turn, if I may, to the merits.
Counsel, very briefly, before you leave standing, in their reply brief as well as on oral argument, they rely upon Mitchell versus Anderson, Michael versus Anderson, for the proposition that the committee of the whole would equal the district of the whole here. Agree, disagree? What's the distinction?
Justice Mims, as I indicated, I think Mitchell is superseded by Raines. The D.C. District Court relied on Mitchell, and the Supreme Court in Raines said the fact that members of Congress may have the effectiveness of their vote diluted is not enough for standing. So I think Raines is dispositive on that point. With regard to the merits of the issue, I think of this in two pieces. One is the plain language of the Constitution, and the other is what do you do with the history? And they're right. There have not been examples of governors in Virginia using this power on a group basis. We start with the plain language. Article 5, Section 12 says, the governor shall have the power to remove political disabilities consequent upon conviction for offenses committed prior or subsequent to the adoption of the Constitution. That power is not qualified by any language. There's no hook in that language where you can hang their argument and say, oh, here's where it imposes an individualized case requirement. It's just not there. This court said in Blount versus Clark that the, quote, the words of Article 5, Section 12 are unambiguous, unquote. There was the unambiguous limitation on exercise of the commutation power except in cases of capital punishment. It didn't matter that for more than 140 years the governors of Virginia had acted contrary to that by issuing commutations in term of year sentences. I think the best case is Lee versus Murphy. Justice Kelsey, you thought Lee versus Murphy should continue to be the law, and I think no one disagreed with you on the court that it still controls. But when you take a look at Lee versus Murphy, take a look at page 803.
It still controls, in a manner of speaking. You realize it was cited by the dissent, by me in dissent. It was certainly not a prominent feature of the majority opinion.
I think the majority agreed with you that the commutation power was limited to capital sentences. The majority recharacterized what the governor did as a partial pardon in order to uphold what he did. But my point is that when you look at page 803, the argument, you recall in Lee, the governor had issued a commutation of a term of year sentence. The court said it was invalid as a commutation, but the court recharacterized it as a conditional pardon. The argument was then made, wait a minute, there haven't been conditional pardons in Virginia. When you look at the Ball versus Commonwealth case, I think it was 1834, the court said in dicta there, we don't have conditional pardons in Virginia. They exist in England, but not here. And this court said in Lee, at page 803, quote, it is not a question of practice, but purely of the interpretation of a plain constitutional provision. So if the plain language of Article 5, Section 12 shows that he has the power, he has the power. It doesn't matter if history doesn't bear out that he's actually exercised the power. And as we pointed out in our brief, citing Boucher versus Sooner, if the Constitution provides the power, it doesn't get lost from non-use. Under their theory, if governors, after the enactment of Article 5, Section 12, hadn't used the clemency power would be lost. And
but
that, of course,
we have a little more than non-use. We have governors, at least in recent times, expressly concluding they lack that power. Isn't that a little bit different?
Well, you're referring to the counsel to Governor Kaine, who was asked on the eve of their departure from office whether this power could be exercised on a group basis. And I think the opinion indicates that he didn't go into it in detail, but he didn't think it would. This court certainly is not, I mean, you're not bound by opinions that we issue. I don't think you're going to be bound by an informal opinion from counsel to the governor.
It is emphatically the province of the judiciary to say what the law is.
Absolutely is. Nothing in Article 2, Section 1 limits the governor's restoration of rights power. That's the text that they rely on. That says no person who's been convicted of a felony shall be qualified to vote unless his civil rights have been restored. Petitioners concede on brief at page 3 of their reply the principle that the singular includes the plural, the masculine includes the singular. That concession, I think, is fatal. Because, and I think the way to think about it is this. Every person whose rights have been restored by the governor's order has had his civil rights restored. That language doesn't speak to the method by which rights are restored, simply to whether they have been restored. And that's why I think the textual argument that they have fails. With regard to their next argument, they say, well, take a look at the next sentence in Article 2, Section 1, dealing with mental competency. Mr. Cooper says it's the same wording. No, it's not. It starts with the phrase, as prescribed by law. And that means that the legislature gets to prescribe the rules that govern mental competency restoration. The governor's never had a role in that. So it's really apples and oranges. And by the way, it would be a very strange place to hide a requirement that the governor has to act on an individualized basis by putting it in Article 2, Section 1, and not by putting it where his power is expressly granted in Article 5, Section 12. So I think the textual argument makes no sense. They argue that there's this general rule of disenfranchisement, and there's an exception here that would swallow the rule. Justice Goodwin, to your point, it's part and parcel of the same thing. The same sentence that says felons are disenfranchised says unless their rights have been restored. And there's no guiding principle that you can discern in the text of the Constitution that would impose some kind of requirement on the governor to ration or limit his clemency power. I think we cited the statistic that there are 450,000 people in Virginia whose rights were who were disenfranchised as of 2010. How many of those could have their rights restored before you violate this rule that they're talking about? They've got no answer to that in their reply brief. Let me talk about the historical argument. This is their best argument. It hasn't been done before. You must not have the power. I've already answered it by the Lee case, but there's really no response by petitioners to our point that if the text of the provision confers the power, history is irrelevant. This court said that in Blount. It said it in Lee. And I think that's dispositive. The main case they rely on in their reply brief is Lewis versus Whittle from 1883. The issue there was who had the power to remove members of the Board of Visitors for the Medical College of Virginia, and the court was interpreting the charter. And the power to remove could have been either with the legislature or the governor. And the language that was used, the charter legislature appointed the initial members of the board and then provided that the governor could fill vacancies that occurred by death, resignation, or otherwise. The court held that the power to fill vacancies is not the power to create vacancies by removing somebody. And it helped resolve the textual analysis by looking at the course of conduct over the prior 29 years. That case isn't anything like this, because in this case, the power to restore rights, I think it's conceded, resides only with the governor. And the question is, what is the plain language and plain meaning of that text? And under the plain language of Article 5, Section 12, he has the power to do what he's done.
As to these other, under this umbrella of clemency, you have the pardon power, remit fines, and so on. Do you agree that as to those powers, the text points in the direction of individualized consideration with this reporting requirement, the need for a conviction, and so on?
I don't think so. I take your point about the second paragraph and the reporting requirement. It says the governor has to report every case. The governor can certainly meet that requirement by reporting every case that's affected by a class-wide pardon. I wouldn't concede that the second paragraph shows that for other acts of clemency, there's a case-by-case requirement. But the fact that the restoration of rights is omitted from that paragraph, I think, says a lot. That they would certainly be here arguing that that proves the case-by-case requirement if it encompassed restoration of rights. It doesn't, and so they can't make that argument. Petitioners have no response in their reply brief to our what I think is our best historical argument, which is based on Article 3, Section 1, Clause 4 of the 1870 Constitution, which was proposed but not ratified by the voters. That would have imposed a case-by-case requirement with regard to restoring the voting rights of people who were disenfranchised because of prior insurrection. The language, and this is at page 36 of the Joint Appendix, the proposed language would have required a vote by the legislature, 3/5 of both houses, quote, by a separate vote in each case. That's the same document where Article 5, Section 12's language was first created. So the framers clearly knew how to impose a case-by-case limitation when they wanted it. They didn't put it in Article 5, Section 12. No response at all to that argument.
Well, isn't the response that that was limited to a very difficult historical event?
Well, I think the history is important in the sense that all of the drafters and the framers, this is during and right after the Civil War. So the people who voted for this Constitution would have benefited from the conditional and then later unconditional general pardons that have been issued first by Abraham Lincoln and then by President Johnson. So they would have been well aware that the executive power includes the power to restore rights and to grant group clemency unless the language constrains it. And they're absolutely right. Our Constitution does have some limitations on power that you don't find in the federal Constitution. This is sort of a consequence of the fact that the more you say, sort of the less power you have. That's why our Constitution, sure, it says no, you can't grant a pardon for someone until after conviction. That's one limitation. The commutation language is another limitation. But there is no limitation on case-by-case review, and the framers clearly knew how to create that when they wanted to. They did it in a different part of the same Constitution. The only fair inference is that they didn't intend for there to be a case-by-case limitation. Let me turn, if I can, talk about standing as the threshold issue, talk about the merits. I want to turn to the other threshold issue, which is this a valid case for mandamus and prohibition? One more point on standing, though. Recall in Raines versus Byrd, that was a really significant controversy. Did Congress have the power to give the president a line item veto in budget matters like we have in Virginia? And six legislators who thought that their voting power was reduced brought an action under the law to challenge the president's conduct. And the court said, you know, it's very tempting in these controversial, important cases to want to get to the merits. But you need to resist the temptation because you end up making bad law on things like standing that will come back to haunt us for many years. And look what happened in Raines. 1 year after Raines versus Byrd was decided, another case came before the court in Clinton versus City of New York, where the court was able to go on and hold unconstitutional the line item veto act. But it came with a party that had proper standing, somebody who lost, you know, funding under the line item veto act, who brought the claim back to the court. It didn't involve a clash between two branches of government. That's the right way to handle it, and we would suggest that's the way to handle it here. With regard to mandamus and prohibition, petitioners have no response to our point that prohibition as a matter of law cannot be used against executive branch officers. That's Birch versus Hardwick. They have no response to our point that under Allen versus Byrd, you cannot use mandamus to require the governor to force him to comply with his take care obligations. This, by the way, is the same rule at the federal level. You cannot mandamus the president or get an injunction against the president. That comes from Mississippi versus Johnson from 1867, where somebody tried to stop Andrew Jackson from enforcing the Reconstruction laws. The Supreme Court said you can't mandamus the president to perform an executive function, and that's exactly what this court said in Allen versus Byrd. The other defect in mandamus and prohibition is that you can't undo an act that's already done. They have to undo the governor's April 22nd order. They cite Town of Front Royal from 1994 as a supposed exception to that requirement, but it's easily distinguished. In Town of Front Royal, there was an annexation order that required the town to extend sewer service to a particular development within 5 years. The town voted and said, we're not going to do that. And then mandamus was brought to make them extend the sewer service, and the court said, no, you can't take advantage of the rule, you can't make us undo an act that's already done simply because we voted not to do it. But what was being enforced there was the prior annexation order. This case is much more like In Re Commonwealth 2002, which is what we cite, where this court said that mandamus does not lie to undo a final order of a court sentencing, in that case, the prisoner to life in prison rather than death. The dissent, interestingly, in In Re Commonwealth cited Town of Front Royal as a way to try to get around the rule that you can't, mandamus can't be used to undo an act already done. The majority didn't accept that. The other case that petitioners rely on, Harrison versus Barksdale from 1920, is likewise distinguishable for the same reason. There, a statute required the judge to certify whether there had been enough votes to effect a change in local government. The judge ruled the other way, and mandamus was allowed to say you've got to comply with the statute. So for these reasons, we think that mandamus and prohibition are simply not available here. The court really should address the threshold questions first. With regard to the remedy, I know everybody's talking about well, how is this going to affect the election? But they're not complaining about the governor's power to restore voting rights. They're saying that he has to do it by a particular way. And so I think it's important to focus on what the case is about and try to ignore the political aspects of it and just focus on the law. And if you focus on the law, the case shouldn't reach the merits. You should dismiss it based on standing or for the failure to allege mandamus and prohibition elements. If you reach the merits, we think it's a pretty easy case because it's covered by the plain language of the Constitution. And if there are no further questions, thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Cooper?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. First, with respect to the three voter statute, your question implies, I think, the answer, which is that if there is a constitutional dimension to standing, then the very same injury that supports standing in the three voter statute supports it here. And if we don't have standing, then that statute must be unconstitutional because it allows any three voters to challenge any single voter in the district. It's purely an overexpansion claim, a vote dilution injury. My second point, with respect to the Michael case, counsel says Raines eliminates that. Well, Your Honor, even if it is true with respect to legislator standing, it is not true with respect to voter standing, and that was the central issue in Michael, whether or not voters, and voters from three different states, and they said voters throughout America could have challenged because of the dilution to their vote in that case. My third point, counsel says non-use of a power given is not, doesn't suggest the power isn't there. This court in Lewis against Whittle made clear that 29 years of non-use of this removal power was itself proof and conclusive proof in that case that the power didn't exist. My time is up, Mr. Chief Justice.
Yes, it has.
Thank you.
The court will be in recess until 10.